home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Whoa, and good evening, good day, good morning, wherever you happen to be listening to this show. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I'm your host, Rob Watson. Garrett Miller might squeak on here at some point. We'll see if that happens, but it would be great if we got the dissension from Blonde Jesus and he actually arrived on our show. That would be cool. But I have fabulous guests lined up for you anyway, and the more the merrier. So what we are going to be talking about tonight is there have been contentious issues around this great ecosphere that is fondly shorthanded as the LGBTQ community, where different infightings have cropped up, which is, we're trying to be more inclusive of other issues. And, that's been a theme that people have carried forth. So these issues are not simple and they are coming up and we need to talk about them and there's going to be division. So that isn't all that unusual. What is kind of concerning, and my reason for pulling the show together specifically on top of those complex issues, is how LGBTQ media is covering a lot of these stories. And they're not all the same. All the different outlets are different. They have their own voices. The gentlemen that I will have on here are two of the best. So when they cover it, they cover it right. But there have been stories out that have been sensationalized, and they have been sensationalized in a way, almost in my mind, to try to stir up trouble or to pit one group of people against the other intentionally. And so part of what I want to talk about tonight is whether that is a healthy trend and whether, our own media is not doing us a disservice. So without further ado, though, I want to bring on our special guests. First of all, veteran journalist, the senior correspondent for the New Civil Rights Movement, long-time feet on the streets guy, and a good friend of mine, Brody Levesque. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So, Brody, before we get started, I want to bring on your another journalist in his own right, veteran award-winning journalist out of Long Beach, California, Philip Zonkel. Philip, welcome to the show. Philip, are you there?
It looks like Phil has dropped off. Hang on a second. I'm getting a message. Let me give Phil a number here because I'm getting a message from him saying, "Are you there, Brody?" And I'm like,
"Oops." Yeah, let me try one other. Philip, are you there?
No.
No. Hi, who do we have online here?
Oh, I guess I didn't know what I'm just a caller. I just thought I didn't know you said what the show is about. It's kind of, how could we say it? I guess I always had a crush on Garrett, but I guess he wouldn't have a crush on me.
Well, it's nice you have a crush on Garrett, madam. I mean, we don't have a problem with that. I'm sure Garrett is.
Well, obviously, you know what I'm saying? I had a crush on Garrett all this time. I had no idea. You know?
No problem.
I'm very upset, you know?
God. Garrett's not dead. He's around. Garrett's schedule is such that he comes on when he can. And he's left a little bit more of the hosting duties to me. So
because what you're saying the show is about, I guess, you know what I'm saying. I didn't know.
you do know that Garrett is gay, right?
What?
You know that Garrett's gay, right?
I didn't know. I didn't know. Oh. And I had a crush on him all this time. This kind of sucks.
Oh, I'm so sorry to be the bearer of bad news. Well, anyway, thank
no,
you for calling.
No, but oh my God. No, I didn't know until.
Coming in on the other line.
Yeah, I'm watching the film. So anyway, I'm going to let you go. Thank you. Keep listening.
I guess you have a crush on Garrett, too. I guess I can't compete, I guess.
He's one of my best friends, but we're not going in that direction. So anyway, thanks for calling in. So, okay, there you go. You know, this is...
I'm so glad
we got the show off to a very serious, deep, thinking.
We're starting off at a superior speed. The message is, I hear people talking, so he's obviously on a board waiting for you.
I see him here. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
There you go. All righty. We got the team on at last. So, yeah, no, it's been interesting. I'm having kind of weird luck with audio stuff lately. You guys are both my Facebook friends, and I shared about this on Facebook. I got a call this week, and the phone rang. I said hello, and the guy said, is the man of the house there? And it was like, it was like this flashback to the 50s, and he said, is the man, I mean, the head of household. And anyway, it was a guy calling for a subscription to the local paper, and I kind of corrected him and said, you know, by the way, you really don't want to start out a phone call that way. And he goes, well, your voice was so youthful, I just couldn't tell. So it got had to break Garrett's fan base heart and out him, and so off we go. So back to the subject. What is the situation as you see it in terms of a lot of the contention going on in, for lack of a better term, our community? Why don't we let you start with that?
Well, for our listeners, and by way of explanation, to put it in context, we've had groups from within the LGBTQ community that of themselves, some of the members of the community and the movement are calling fringe left. And this has caused some rather contentious confrontations at Pride events. The most recent one being in Chicago, at the Chicago Dyke March. Now, the Chicago Dyke March is an annual event. It's put on every year, every Pride. This year, we had a group from A Wider Bridge, which is a predominantly Jewish organization, and they were flying rainbow flags that had the Star of David on them. The problem is that people got bent out of shape calling these flags Zionist and pro-Israeli, and it got kind of ugly. And one of the reasons it got ugly was because A Wider Bridge has taken a political position in their activism that affirms their support for the state of Israel. But the problem was that's not what they were at the Dyke March for. And the flag as it presented was not an Israeli flag. It was not a pride adaptation of the Israeli flag. It was simply a pride flag with the Star of David, which is an emblem of the Jewish faith, on the flag. But
right.
In the last 5 or 6 days, the online and offline battling over this issue has gotten really, really seriously ugly, and people have been tossing, you know, bombs at each other. You know, I had a discussion with a gentleman who was saying, well, then why don't we have pride flags with Nazi swastika and that sort of thing. So,
right.
And this particular argument, its genesis was a month ago in the city of Philadelphia. The newly appointed director of LGBTQI affairs for the city of Philadelphia, Amber Hikes, had declared that one of the things that she wanted to do was to be a little bit more inclusive of queer and LGBTQI people of color, because Philadelphia has been having a real problem within the gay community in terms of discriminatory practices and, quite frankly, some rather biased and bigoted things that were going on. Their solution was to add two stripes to the pride flag, black and brown, to represent the disenfranchised communities or the communities that they felt were being discriminated against. Well, that was actually supposed to be Philly-centric, and unfortunately, like everything else these days, it went viral, and it got interpreted, it got twisted, and it really got ugly. And as a matter of fact, we're still seeing a lot of residual arguments about that. Now,
right.
At the
and
same
Cody,
time, that this was going on, we have four different prides, New York, Washington, D.C., Miami, and Chicago, where we had groups of queer and queer identifying primarily youth of color, okay, who are upset with corporate sponsorship of Pride and who are upset with law enforcement participating in Pride. So over the last 3 or 4 months, we have suddenly seen a compounding of what was going on. Now, before I did the show tonight, last night I had a long conversation with Ken Sherrill out of New York. Ken is a, if you will, a Stonewall veteran. And he was at the first march in 1970 with Mark Siegel, Jack Nichols, Lige Clark, and everything. He made an
Brody,
interesting
I want
comment
to, I want
that
to
I'm
take
going to throw
a
out
wait,
there.
Wait, hold on. Hold
well,
on.
Let me,
I want
let
to,
me finish
you...
my thought because I want to, this is important to the conversation. The context of the conversation that Ken threw out there and should probably be, we should be thinking about as we discuss each of these has to center around, Ken said this to me, and Phil, you may or may not agree with this, and Rob, I'm not sure. Every movement, but particularly our movement, the LGBTQI movement, has always been afraid of its fringe. That was his statement. Okay, I'm done.
Okay. No, well, actually, I wasn't trying to get you to end. I just wanted, before you moved on to other things, I wanted to go back to a couple of those because the color behind a couple of those in terms of the media coverage and the way they came
mm-hmm.
out, particularly the
yeah.
Philadelphia one, came out first,
yeah.
At least where I first saw it was in Out magazine, then CNN picked
mm-hmm.
it up. Neither one of those
yes.
in any way indicated
mm-hmm.
that this was a flag for Philadelphia, nor did either one of those accounts give any kind of flavor as to what Philadelphia specifically was dealing with and the motivation and need for that initiative. They both came out as, gee, Philadelphia is redefining the rainbow flag. So, which is a whole different conversation than
mm-hmm.
here's something that's going on in this location and, you know, that's very real. And this is, you know, this is a flag that we want to
mm-hmm.
help represent that issue. Likewise, on
right.
the Chicago March, you just gave mm-hmm. it a little more depth in how you just described it than what I was reading in the different gay media, which simply was, you know, boom, you know, this lesbian was thrown out of the march. She was thrown out for the, you know, she wanted to carry the flag. It gave her reaction to it, and the fact that the Star of David was seen by the promoters or the march
organizers
as a trigger. Well, the one thing,
yeah.
because I've
yeah.
talked to some people who were there and involved
mm-hmm.
also, and I'm not taking a side on this, but just to give it a little more depth, was that the march itself, and I don't know why this was, but they say this was how it was positioned as a pro or supportive of Palestinian and refugee
mm-hmm.
march to incorporate those
mm-hmm.
particular groups of that they viewed as people of color. So it was
right.
a little more context than simply a dyke march that had a Jewish participant. You know, now I still see that they were, that was not handled well, you know, because it was to all your points, Brody, you know, the way it was represented. So what is your take on how these events are being covered and your take on the events themselves and what's going on in the community?
Phil and I have actually had this conversation
well,
over the last several months. And I think, Phil, I'm going to let you go first because you and I have talked about this very issue.
You know, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, one of the things that kind of pops into my mind immediately is I kind of wonder if people on the far right or folks that are not in favor of LGBTQ equality, if in any way, shape, or form, they're kind of sitting back and going, divide and conquer, divide and conquer, divide and conquer. If they're kind of hoping that these situations will cause splinters within the groups, within our larger movement, and cause these splintering factions, because it seemed like that for a little while, well, I don't know if a little while is the right term, but it seemed like there was a lot of kind of cohesion and unity happening rather quickly. And you saw a few little kind of splinter things that would happen here or there where there were disagreements, but it seemed like overall the community was together on a lot of issues and moving forward. And all of a sudden there's this, you know, there's a lot of kind of division. You know, I think some of the questioning, I mean, I think is certainly interesting and I think is worthy and great to have. I remember a couple of years ago, there were various pro-immigration groups that were protesting about Wells Fargo, for example, being in gay pride parades because they would say, hey, Wells Fargo is one of the largest investors of private prisons in the United States, and one of the largest populations that are put in private prisons are people that are undocumented. And so that was kind of – and it's an interesting conversation. And it's an interesting issue to bring up. You know, I think the media being lazy sometimes – and not putting the full context on something is not in any way, shape, or form surprising. I mean, that happens, and I would, you know, maybe in some way, shape, or form, we need to have a, I don't know if rapid response is the right response to have, but if there's something that is being covered on an extremely superficial level and there's more context with the Dyke March, with the Philadelphia flag incident, maybe in some way, shape, or form going, hey, wait, you guys have this wrong. Because it kind of perpetuates that fire and keeps going and going. And I think all of us on this call understand that something like CNN says something, it like wildfire just gets spread and people think CNN said it, must be accurate. I'm not saying CNN's not accurate, but there's that potential that if something isn't the full story, whoosh, it just like takes off. And then trying to put that genie back in the bottle is extremely, extremely difficult. So, did I answer your question?
Yeah, no, you well, totally did. The thing that I'm kind of wondering about, though, and I'd love both your perspectives on this, is
sure.
that so much of the writing, particularly in the LGBTQ press, is not just mm-hmm. omission or not quite getting everything in there. There seems to be mm-hmm. especially in certain publications, and I won't mention which ones, that it is trying to rile up that perception, exactly what you were saying, Philip, of divide and conquer. For example, I saw an article about how bi people were not feeling welcome at Pride. That was the title of the article. And in the article itself, there were no studies, no surveys done, nothing in depth that would give that credence. It was very anecdotal. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the anecdotes were, quite frankly, incredibly thin. I mean, for example, the one interview in that article, and it was a good portion of the article, was a woman who is bisexual, who is married to a man, who went to Pride and was irritated that people perceived them as a straight couple. And it was like, I read that and it was like, okay, if that's the basis for this article that is titled "Bi People Don't Feel Welcome at Pride," that's ridiculous. Because, I mean, mm-hmm. that is not, that there is, I mean, I don't think it would be at all unusual, nor would it be the through the motivation of wanting to suppress bi people, that if you see a man and a woman couple together, that you would, the majority of those kind of couples are going to be heterosexual. And so it might be great if you stopped and thought, they, one or two of them might be bisexual, or they might be on a spectrum or whatever, but you're not going to assume they're bisexual. So,
you're thinking these are clickbaits then. This is another example of clickbait, someone to ooh, controversy,
right,
click, and it's really just
exactly
nothing. Is that what you're
exactly
worth? You know, that's
the problem. The problem with that is that editors write those headlines, and Phil and I both know this. You know, as reporters, as journalists, and in my case as a senior editor, one of the things that I realize is that I'm going to get copy, but 9 times out of 10, a journalist may not be very good at writing headlines. I mean, I have made no bones about the fact I don't write good headlines. So I have, in my career, which is approaching 40 years now, I have always let the senior editorial staff do their own headlines. And I do that with the understanding that that's exactly what they're going for. You know, in the old days, it was write the headline so that you could sell newspapers. And nowadays, it's write the headline so you get someone to click on it, or clickbait is the term they use. The problem is the context. I have seen publications, and unfortunately, I will say this, the LGBTQI media in general is the worst offender of this, because everybody is trying within the niche of the LGBTQI press, okay, to get everybody's attention and to do it in such a way that they're going to click on it. And the problem is that if you do that on some of these stories, you're losing the context of what the story is all about. A headline, a good headline, is to mirror and complement the lead. That's all
right.
It's supposed to do. It's to give enough information so that the reader's going to be motivated to go ahead and start the read. The problem is if you've got people who, quite frankly, don't understand that principle or do not understand the practices of good journalistic ethos and standards, bloggers are a good example of this, you know, it's all about the click. What gets lost in that is the story and the context of the story. Let's go back to Philadelphia. The problem with the Philly story from the inception, okay, if you'll remember, Rob, you sent me a Facebook message, and I called Miss Hicks, okay?
Right.
And I talked to her. She told me that outside of the local paper, which is Mark Siegel's, by the way, the Philly Gay News, and it's a pretty damn good gay publication. It's one, I think it and the Washington Blade are the two oldest in the nation. Outside of the Philly paper, she hadn't gotten any calls from the rest of the, you know, queer media, including out. So
wow,
that tells that people aren't doing their damn jobs.
Right.
All right. So what mm-hmm. happens, and Phil can vouch for this, it, you know, you get a young kid in his 20s, okay, or her 20s, and she's been given an assignment or she's doing writing for one of these publications, and they're told to do what's called a pickup or a write-around piece. What that is, translating for the audience, is you take someone else's work, you put your own spin on it, you quote, if you have any sense of ethos and standards at all whatsoever, okay, you attribute and quote, okay, the other source, whatever the publication was, and then you put it together in such a way that your readers are going to be getting the information. And in today's digital journalism, that means you've got to be able to do that in 300 words or less. Well, that means these kids are writing copy, but they're just doing pickup pieces, and they may not necessarily understand the context to it. Now, you get an old fart like me or Phil, and what we're going to do is we'll read that, and then we're going to pick up the phone. We're going to do our job. Phil
right.
would do the same damn thing I do. I would call Philly, and I did. Miss Hicks, hi, I'm Bodie Levesque. I'm the chief political correspondent for the new civil rights movement. I'm also a senior editor for Agency France Presse. I'd like to talk to you about this controversy over your flag if you have a few minutes. Well, she had 30 minutes for me, okay? Then I didn't stop there. I turned around and I called Cleve Jones, because Cleve Jones was best friends with Gilbert Baker, who designed the flag, okay?
Right.
Cleve's reaction, which was based strictly on what you just said, Out Magazine and CNN, and the viral thing about the Pride flag getting, you know, changed, was, for the most part, unprintable. And it was coming from a perspective of, okay, he was angered because he saw it as dishonoring Gilbert's memory, dishonoring Gilbert's intent, and dishonoring the intent of the flag itself, because the meaning behind those 6 stripes, originally 8, hell, you can look it up on Wikipedia if you want, all right? And race had nothing to do with it. But it was the context overall that got lost, and the reason the context got overall lost was because nobody was doing their damn job. Phil?
No, I think what you're saying is super important, Brody. And I mean, I know, you know, I was part of that because you were calling her and you invited her on the other radio show. But that was conversation we had was the first time I got a sense, because you had talked to her, of what the project was really about. That was about their issues there, that something she was trying to accomplish. But the other thing that you were saying that really resonates with me is a lot of the pieces that I'm reading in so many of it's the, in the gay and progressive press, they are exactly what you're saying. They're taking some facts from a third party article, and then the bulk of the article is that writer telling me, the reader, how outraged I should be about it and why. And
that's not journalism. That is not journalism.
Yeah, they are almost, I mean, I am literally finding them unreadable, because I, in many cases, I can't even really determine what really happened, because the writer is telling me how outraged I need to be. And I'm on the same page with them. I probably would be that outraged. You know, a prime example of that, and Brody, this is about a person you and I have slightly different perceptions on, but Caitlyn Jenner made a really stupid, asinine remark to a bunch of Republicans, and, you know, something about, you know, liberals can't shoot straight or something to that effect, which was bad, and it was awful and stupid on her part, et cetera. The take on it from one of the publications was so out there that when I was reading it, I completely lost my disgruntledness with Ms. Jenner, because they pushed it to this unrecognizable outrage that was bizarre, was just absolutely bizarre, trying to make them remark homophobic and all this stuff.
Phil and I are both mainstream journalists, and I need to make that point very clear. Phil and I both come from the same background. We are not queer media. We're not queer journalists, gay journalists, whatever. Phil and I are journalists who happen to be gay. Phil and I both are mainstream journalists. He did his time at Press-Telegram in Long Beach, California. I did mine with Reuters News Service and the wire services. But Phil and I were both trained the same way, okay? And that makes a distinct difference when you are talking about doing proper journalism. You know, it's a disservice to readership. It's a disservice to the LGBTQI community. You know, I've heard the thing called trigger warning tossed around so much in the last week, it's incredible. And most of the blame for the trigger warning is the LGBTQI media's fault itself. Now, I understand intuitively and academically and any other way you want to phrase it, that because we have been a persecuted and minority community for as long as anyone can remember, and we're just now truly coming onto our own, where we're not going to find ourselves getting arrested or chemically castrated or God knows whatever, that there's still a little bit of touchiness that's involved, because we still have, quite frankly, the Christian right, the Jewish right, the Islamic right, and the right in general, okay, that still think that we're the spawn of Satan. I get that. But the thing is we can't not properly serve our community if we sit there and fiddle fart around with the facts, and we do the exact same thing that I would toss a kid out of my journalism classes for, and that is to editorialize and colorize. Our responsibility as journalists, who, what, where, when, why, how, occasionally how come, we let the reader determine how they're going to interpret the facts. Our damn job is to present them. It doesn't do the general community, the niche community, any damn good when you have people doing the crap that you're describing. It drives me crazy. Okay, I'm going to get off my soapbox. It's Phil's turn.
Yeah, and Phil, do you want to touch on
what we've seen? Yeah.
Yeah, well, also, I want you to, whatever thoughts on your mind, but I also want to see if you can address the question that Brody asked earlier about a community being afraid of its fringe and your thoughts on that. And I have my two cents on that as well, but I want to hear you first.
Wow. You know, it's funny. I mean, I think Los Angeles in some ways, and speaking only kind of from the LA perspective, I guess, if you will, excuse me, you know, LA is very different than San Francisco in terms of, you know, organizing and politically involved. We definitely have had aspects of those and such, but I don't know if we're as politically involved to have that. I don't know if that's been an issue that we have in LA have been afraid of that fringe. I mean, maybe historically we have, and I'm just missing those certain points or whatnot, but you know, for a while, the kind of joke in at least LA is that, you know, the gay community is so apathetic that if they can get concerned about anything, they're just excited about that. Forget what it is, just excited, period. So I think there's, and the elements where they're, and again, if I'm wrong in some of these parts, you know, chime in and correct me. It seems like, and one of these was not actually in Los Angeles. I think it happened in Arizona this year. And I want to say perhaps last year when there was a pride parade. I'm not sure if it was in Phoenix or not, but earlier this year, and I think it happened last year as well, there were some immigration groups that kind of protested the pride parade and stopped it because they felt a lack of inclusion of queer undocumented people being included. And the response mm-hmm. from the gay community was rather hostile. I mean, there was a lot of kind of, and it seemed to expose in a brighter light and perhaps for folks in a better way, elements of racism that I think have been there for a long time, but perhaps have been kind of hidden or covert. I think it exposed certain warts, if you will, that the community maybe A, has not wanted to acknowledge or B, has tried to deny. And people were like upset about it, that they had stopped the parade. They weren't even addressing the message. It was just that, hey, you stopped our parade. There were even some folks earlier this year, or I guess just earlier this month, when we had the Resist March in L.A. instead of an actual pride. I mean, it was still run by the Christopher Street West, but as opposed to a parade, it was a Resist March. And there were some people that were upset that there wasn't a parade because they wanted floats and to have fun. And they were like, we have gay marriage. What are we resisting for? So you had that element to it. But in terms of being, again, going back, in terms of being afraid of the fringe left, I don't know if I've seen that per se here in L.A. Again, maybe it is and I'm just missing it or I've been out of the loop a little bit on that. But I don't know to the extent that is in Los Angeles. Maybe it's more maybe in, say, San Francisco where it's a little more politically involved. You know, New York, other parts of the country where there's a much more actively involved, politically active gay community.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and I kind of come from L.A. I've been up here now more years than I care to admit. It's been about 18 years I've been in Northern California, but, you know, I actually lived in Long Beach for quite a few years and was in West Hollywood. Yeah. Through the all of the AIDS crisis and everything else. And Brody, you know, right. It's a very interesting mm-hmm. concept. The thing, here's what I would throw out to you guys, though, just from my life observation, was that this idea of the LGBTQ community is kind of fake at the outset. Because when I was younger and in West Hollywood, there was barely community within one group. But there was complete fractionalization around like the gay men versus the lesbians, you know, bisexuals
right.
kind of was seen actually derided and for reason, because one of the experiences that a lot of gay people, lesbian and gay men had was bisexuals coming in and kind of using gay people as their play on the side, go back to their solid marriage, because that's what society was built on then. There was no gay marriage. There were no rights whatsoever. In fact, there were discouragements from supporting gay relationships or lesbian relationships. So, you know, there was no call for anybody to cooperate, care about, be interested in whatsoever. It wasn't until the AIDS crisis when gay men were getting sick and all of a sudden there was this huge obvious injustice happening to somebody in the community that other parts of the community, and it was mostly the lesbians who stepped up and crossed the line mm-hmm. over into a more coalition kind of way. And the things that have happened since then, since that started coming together, was that different injustices is sort of like a bunch of different people caught in the same rainstorm. So everybody pulled together mm-hmm. under similar umbrellas. And that's what right. has moved us forward as we battle Don't Ask, Don't Tell, DOMA, you know, all of those things we've now battled collectively. So now at the end of that, I think it's sort of not a real thing that cohesion was ever a real concept. I think it
was... The thing of it is that you're absolutely correct. Let me go back to what the Stonewall veteran told me in my interview with him last night. Okay, for example, in the early 1980s, the Pride Parade organizers would be terrified if NAMBLA would show up. They would be terrified if the transvestite, right. that's what they were referred to in those days, showed up in full drag. In other words, what they were afraid of was seeing the extreme parts of the fringe. But when you look at the LGBTQI community, it's a political construct. So here's the thing. You have to look at seminal events within the movement. You have to look at the things that drove them in. You know, you talk about the AIDS crisis. That's only one issue. I look at other issues as a political reporter. I look at the first march in 87, you know, which was kicked off by Cleve, actually, with his AIDS, the AIDS quote. I look at the march in 93. The march in 93 is a seminal event because it marks the first time that we began to see true political power being exerted by these different groups. Up until that point, there was no political power, period. The gays didn't have it. The lesbians didn't have it. Nobody in the queer community had political power. If anything, they were fighting for their very lives. You had a hostile administration, the Reagan administration, not followed by the Bush administration, which didn't help. But on top of that, you had a society. It was a societal thing. So what we ended up with, as we're looking back from 2017 backwards, we're looking at the fact that it is very much a political construct. And the reason is because since 93 forward, there has been an ascendancy of political power that's being gathered up by certain members of the movement, okay, to be sure, organizations in particular, HRC, GLAAD, PFLAG, the National Task Force, these are your headliners, if you will, the Equality Federation. And along the way, as this political construct has been going on, certain events, such as the tragic murder of Judy Shepard's son, Matthew, in Laramie in 98,
right.
such as, you know, the National March in 93, such as DOMA, such as Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Pushing forward, you have an uneasy alliance in some instances, which we're seeing today with the transgender problem, that they're at the tip of the spear, and they're being persecuted just completely off the rail. But we're not seeing true measures of support the way we should be seeing them. And yet within the community, I can remember back in 03 when the Human Rights Campaign threw the entire transgender community under the damn bus, okay, over equal rights, all right, over equality rights, over basically their right to exist. So there is a balkanization, if you will. And as the Stonewall veteran pointed out to me, this is a historic one. This goes back even to the very first march, the Christopher Street March in 1970. Okay? So it's not – you're absolutely correct. But the thing is what does not help this, what really is an impediment to people being able to come across or reach across aisles or whatever you want to put it, okay, is the fact that there's no central unifying theme. You know, for a while there, everybody was on board with same-sex marriage. Okay, well, that's all well and good, but that doesn't do a transgender person a bit of damn good, okay, if they get fired from their jobs or they're denied housing, does it?
Well,
it doesn't
that's
do
true for but that's,
let me
that's
finish.
Really, that's,
it doesn't do those queer kids any good. And see, this is the thing that the Stonewall veteran was pointing out to me, is that the political construct means that the alliances within the construct aren't really strong enough. As a member of the LGBTQI media, I have a tendency to go, yeah, I think part of that's our fault because we're not even helping those queer kids of color out. So it's a multifaceted issue from my perspective.
Right. Except that I would disagree with one thing you just said, though, in that you know, the gay marriage thing or the marriage equality thing, actually it does help transgender people in the same way it helps a gay person or a lesbian person, in that it and I've got a couple in Mississippi that was a prime example of that, because it does it removes the attack that is on them and when they're forming their, you know, marital relationships. It takes the issue off the table for them. But it, you know, it's just like lesbians and gay people in states that have no employment protection, the same thing holds true across the board. It isn't an end-all initiative in itself. But what it did do, and I think it's important to put it in context of the progression, because what happened was we as in the 80s, you know, you brought out Cleves March in 87. Well, 87 was way after the fact of AIDS. I had so many dead friends by 87, I can't even tell you. And the clout of the gay community and the lesbian community was pretty much nil, to the point that the only thing that we had effect over and were able to even get in there in the hearts and minds of America was through Ryan White, a straight hemophilic boy. Not anybody gay. Right. You know, we couldn't present because we had no power, no sympathy, no nothing. So that all got built through that. But the series of issues that we've been successful at, don't ask, don't tell, being able to serve openly in the military. Well, once people in a society are able to serve openly in the military, the general population is going to look at them and go, and they're willing to die for us, but we're not letting them marry who they want. That's not right. You know, and before that, you know, it's like it was employment, you know, in certain states protections where, and the population was behind equal employment rights, even though it's not legislatively equal across the country, but the public was with this. So once these things started going in that direction, the public then warmed up to the next level of equality. So it all does feed eventually. But to your point,
my point is what the Stonewall veteran was telling me is that we have these fringe groups within this political construct called the LGBTQI community that are not being carried along on those coattails, and I agree with them.
Well, I would support that even more now, because what I'm hearing now and a lot of the things that are being done now, they are not addressing the issues you brought up. They're being done in more of a showy way, you know, under that guise, but the activists that are doing them are not bringing up the big issues. The two issues that I brought up recently on my show that I think are vitally important, actually three, I'm thinking more and more, but the issues are age for people of color, especially in the South, is on the verge of being another huge, huge AIDS health crisis. You know, no one's talking about it. The issue with this officer getting off after he brutally shot an innocent black male, you know, passenger in a car. You know, it's like that.
So in Minnesota, right?
I talked about this on Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
That is systemized terrorism. It's like I know so many families whose African-American families and gay dad families whose kids are African-American. They are all terrified for their kids with reason. You know, it's like those are the issues. And these, you know, parades are not being stopped for those issues. Those are not what people are talking about. So I still
the problem is that, you know, if you, and this comes back to Phil and my profession, one of the problems that we're having is those issues are there, and those kids are actually talking about those issues, but those of us in the press are not, and it's our fault.
When you mentioned the word fringe earlier, I think when I, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you said the word fringe, I was thinking of I guess, like dictionary definition of the term fringe, you know, some far, you know, look at the bell curve, way on the end. But it sounds like what you're saying by fringe, you're talking lesbians, people of color. So I need to kind of go back with what I was saying that, I mean, that's gone on. That has been, you know, I mean, lesbians continually would say, hey, we're not part of the equation. We're not part of the conversation. Include us in. I mean, that, I don't know if that's, if you would address that as being, you know, sexism, misogyny, racism. I guess in some ways it's a reflection of society larger at hand.
Yes.
And certainly we need to do a much better job of bringing all those folks. I mean, this just sounds kind of simplistic, but getting all those folks together, because certainly the one thing, you know, throw a buzzword out there is the term, you know, intersectionality. We've heard that term a lot in the, it seems to me in the past couple of years, more so than I ever have, unless I've just been kind of out of the loop. But I think as people are pointing those things out, I think it is kind of showing that, oh, this is related to that, and the Black Lives Matter movement is related to us, and how these things kind of fit together. And I think it seems to me when people are shown how those things connect together, how those dots are put together, they then kind of see, I can see those kind of those light bulbs go off, like, oh, I get it. Oh, a lesbian issue should be important to me because that might impact someone in my family or my neighbor, or my friend. When you make it, I guess like all things, when you make it personal for someone so they can relate to it, how this impacts you, why you should care about this, then people get concerned, they get passionate, they want to get involved about it, and they want to, you know, and I think also it increases our numbers and increases our allies. I mean, that's nothing new. I mean, Cleve Jones talked about, you know, the labor movement, working with the gay. I mean, it's the way that we kind of find more and more support and find more and more strength. So in terms of being afraid of the fringe, I don't know if that's an example of members of the community who are, take your pick, racist, misogynistic, sexist, maybe they're all of that, and they're not wanting their part of the kingdom to be given up. They want to control the message, the narrative, because then if they lose that, what do they do? Maybe if they're losing some sort of power, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess there could be a part of that involved in it. But, you know, I'll tell you, I guess, whether they like it or not, from some of the younger activists, like, you know, people that are in their 20s or in college or maybe in their early 30s, I mean, they're pushing, and I mean that in a positive way, or they're broadcasting those messages loud and clear. They're not going to go away. I mean, they're savvy enough and clever enough, not only with the message, but how to get the message out to people, social media and whatever, it's not going to go away. And they might become quiet or become, maybe say, like dormant, but I'll guarantee you that's just the calm before the storm. What they're probably just doing is regrouping and rethinking, how do we do this? How do we do this? How do we do this? I mean, I've watched people do it and I've seen it happen. So it kind of reminds me of Billy Tomlin in Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, when Trudy says to the aliens, evolve or die, evolve or die. You know, maybe we're coming to this crossroads for the community where it's like, we have to make these decisions. It's like, look, we cannot in any way, shape, or form go backwards, and we have to confront those issues in the community. I mean, literally, I mean, confront them head on and call people out. You know, I think we're seeing more and more, at least I'm seeing more and more articles within gay media or things shared on Facebook talking about racism within the gay community.
Yeah.
You know, for a while it kind of was like a wink and a nod where people would say, you know, oh, are those thugs going to be at the gay pride? Are they going to be, what are those guys doing in our club? Or what are they doing here? And we just kind of, some people just kind of let that go as opposed to saying, why not? Why can't they be here? Why shouldn't they be here? I mean, we really, I think, need to be direct and call those things out right when we see them. And I guess I'll ask for clarity. Do they mean this or do they mean that? You know, and just do that. But I think going back to the earlier point also, you know, the issues of, I guess, maybe irresponsibility or laziness in journalism, I guess we're seeing the same impacts, not the same impacts, we're seeing the same effects that mainstream media had in terms of fake news. You know, you see these stories that go viral that are –
I think we lost Phil, actually.
I think we lost Phil.
I'm looking at the board.
He was hitting. He must have walked. He said he got a bad cellar. He was in Long Beach and not walking a bad cellar yet. But while we're waiting for him to call back,
Yeah, no,
his point that was taken, the one thing that the guy said to me, which you and I have had this conversation, and when Bill comes back, you know, a Capitol Pride, one of the things that it was the reaction more than anything else by a segment of the community about what was going on with another segment of the community. Phil just called it racism. There were people in the Capitol Pride region that were calling it, you know, white privilege and problems and things like that. Now, the Stonewall veteran said something really interesting to me last night, was that he said that as a group, meaning the entire acronym, LGBTQI, it should never be a case that it should never be a business of silencing anyone's speech, regardless of whether you agreed or disagreed. You cannot do that. And the biggest problem, and this is from his vantage point, and I think it's from mine as well, was there was too many people, because he was at the New York parade and they had some problems. And, of course, I'm a former resident of Washington, but I have friends that live there. And that really was a problem. There were too many folks that were only too willing to silence the speech. You know, it comes down to...
And
you know, whether or not
sides.
We agree or disagree, you know.
Yeah,
well,
and it's happening on both sides.
It's happening on both sides, but the problem is the preponderance of responsibility and accountability is not with these kids, okay? I don't necessarily agree with everything that comes flying out of them, but the thing is they've made a really valid point within the LGBTQI community, and that is going back to what the Stonewall veteran says. If we don't have a right to silence this, and we need to have these discussions, okay, Phil's just sending me a message. I'm back
on
the phone.
Yeah,
he's
back. It's okay. I got it ready. Keep talking.
That we have a responsibility. And you know, Phil calls it racism. I'll call it what it is. It's white privilege because it's been top-heavy in the movement for a long time in terms of your what I call Gay Inc., the Human Rights Campaign, GLAAD, you know, the task force, and that has been a perception by these groups, which I call fringe, you can call them disenfranchised, it doesn't matter, it's the same groups, that's where the power is. In other words, the power is the ruling, you know, stereotype of the rich gay guy. Wrong, right, or indifferent, that's the perception, and this is what they are combating, and that's when we have a problem where neither side's willing to come to the table and talk to each other because you got one group saying this, 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 and this, and you got the other one saying this, that, and that, and no one's listening to the other side. The Stonewall veteran made an interesting point to me. In the early days of the movement, he was part of it, you know, people have to come together and have a consensus because they were fighting a larger problem. Well,
no, I agreed.
Well,
agreed.
The problem they were fighting back then is the same problem that we're fighting now. And
right.
It's a,
yeah, no, absolutely. Well, actually, I think in the past, I don't think there was even any guys that people were trying to get to a common table at a certain point. But the thing now, and I agree with you. I mean, there's corporate Gay Inc. and, you know, you can call it white privilege, and which is, you know, it's predominantly white. But it's the politicized lobby group. I mean, they're playing the game. They're playing the corporate game. They're playing the big government game. And absolutely, the voice of these younger people should be part of that. But it's like I've seen silence happening on both sides. The question I want to ask you guys, though, because we only got about 6 minutes left, and this is really one that I want you guys to address, is some of these issues do not have an easy right or wrong. I mean, in Chicago, you're dealing with two disenfranchised groups in direct conflict, where there's another situation that came up that I'm going to talk about on the Out in Santa Cruz show with a she's an activist, African-American woman. She's pro getting rid of violence out of the African-American community. She is actually pro trans people doing self-determination and living their authentic selves, that she is adamant that cisgender women should have their own private spaces. She thinks anything where a penis in the anatomy could at all be evidenced is very threatening to women, and so she is very against the transgender bathroom rights. So where, you know, and she's being called names, transphobic, everything else. I don't agree with her. I think there's a solution to that. But how do we get something where we have two factions that both have cases to the table to find a common ground that isn't, you know, one side or the other? How do we get that kind of balance conversation going? Bill, do you have
I think like on The Simpsons, you put Homer and Ned Flanders in a room and you lock the door. Oh, it was Homer and Principal Skinner, and then you lock the. I'm just kidding. It did work on The Simpsons, though. You know, I mean, I guess the old-fashioned talk and see if there's some sort of consensus. If, you know, one of the things that sometimes brings people that have different points of view in some way, shape, or form together is maybe focusing on what they have in common, focus on those strengths, and then maybe work from there. I know sometimes the, you know, religious right has done that before. They will, they've been involved with other different organizations. They are adamantly against. They go, hey, we have this in common. Let's join forces on this conversation or on this particular issue. You know, I think, I mean, again, I mean to sound hokey, though. I mean, I'm in the business of communication. I think I'll, you know, there's a time when talking, I think, exhausts itself. But I think letting people air those differences and throw them out there and start talking and see where it can go, I think can be interesting and can really be fascinating and can lead to some solutions, or may bring up some other issues, or may expose some other things, or bring issues to light that people weren't aware of. You know, it might bring maybe someone might think this person, and I'm not referring to women in Chicago, but maybe someone has an opinion and someone might think, oh, this is a person who is solo in their belief. Maybe they represent that unspoken majority or that silent majority that we sometimes hear about. I mean, all these things, I think, in some way, shape, or form are are complex and have multiple layers to them. And I think it's definitely worth, you know, the issue earlier about, you know, Wells Fargo hosting you know, being in a gay pride parade, giving money. Yeah, but they also, you know, invested in private prisons, which imprisoned a lot of undocumented, you know, queer youth. That's an interesting topic. What do you do about that? Is there an answer?
Right.
Maybe there are
right.
levels of answers. Maybe there are types. Maybe there's priorities of answers. You know, there might not be a cut and dry or a thing to do in this. You know, certainly when it comes to, I don't mean to simplify this, from a journalistic perspective, you know, we have that separation in journalism between advertising and editorial. In many buildings, they are on either different floors or in different parts of a floor, so there's no contact between them because they're completely separate entities and they're dealt with as separate entities. And if an advertising person comes to editorial and says, hey, I have this story idea for you, there's a chain of command to follow with that.
Philip, we are literally at the end here. And I want to thank you both for coming on. The one parting shot I would leave you guys with is, because we are not in a situation as a quote unquote community where we truly have a community government or some sort of central hall to discuss these things, because I totally support what you're saying, Philip. My suggestion is that we do it in the gay media. I would love to see.
But then we're going to have to make sure that the gay media does its job and quit telling people what to think. That's not our job. Our job is to inform people.
Right. Create that forum where those issues can be laid out fully and succinctly and with all sides there, so that people can see it and find a common ground and it not go to the level it is. So anyway, thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Listen also to Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday night, 7 p.m., and we will be promoting that as well. I want to thank my guests, Brody Levesque, as always, seasoned and expert journalist, and likewise award-winning journalist, Philip Zunkel, and all the work that you guys are doing is fantastic. So stay tuned for us next week. We will be
back. Thank you, Rob.
And Thanks again, guys, for being on.
No problem.
Thank you.
Bye.